The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
most prominent
sports columnists.
Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us again on the Mike Lupica Podcast. We're excited today. We've got the co-creator and showrunner and executive producer of Showtime's Billions joining us. That's Brian Koppelman. He's also the man who brought you Rounders and Ocean's 13 and hosts his own entertaining podcast, The Moment. And with season four of Billions about to begin, we are so happy to talk about that with Brian and his man Tiger Woods and the state of the nation and the Oscars. And before we get started with him, I want to tell you about Geico. There's a quick way you could save money. Just switch to Geico. All it takes is 15 minutes to find out if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. And Geico offers coverage for more than just car insurance. Got a motorcycle? Geico's got you covered. Got an RV? Covered. Got a boat? Covered. How about a homeowner's or renter's insurance? You bet Geico's got you covered. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save. That's geico.com. Welcome back to the Mike Lupica Podcast, and we are joined today by one of my favorite people on the planet, one of the most talented people I know. His name is Brian Koppelman. He is the co-creator. He is the showrunner. He is the executive producer of Billions, which is, for my money, the single hottest show on television. We're getting ready for season four. He is a Knicks fan. He's a Tiger Woods fanboy. So we've got to discuss the country today, the Oscars, season four of Billions, in which I will try in vain to get anything out of him. I just watched the trailer again to get myself psyched up. But first of all, greetings, Mr. Koppelman.
Mike, Mr. Lupica, sir. It's awesome always to talk to you. Love you. And really happy to get to talk to you today, and really happy that you're where you are and I'm here, because otherwise you might have come to rehearsal this morning and you could have whispered something to one of my actors that would have taken me months to repair.
Okay, so full disclosure here is Brian and I, and he was generous enough to do this podcast as he's shooting Billions. He said, listen, we might not be able to go at the appointed time because I'm rehearsing a scene. And I generously, I thought, offered to help with that and discuss, you know, not blocking necessarily, but motivation and, you know, what we were going for. We, meaning you, me and David in the scene. And you told me that you thought that would be a good idea. But what season did you say, Brian?
Well, I felt, and I think my partner, you know, and all that stuff, show running, producing the show and creating it, David Levine, would agree with me that when you should come in and give your sort of expert added help is around season 17.
Sure.
Or something like that.
Sure.
I think around season 17. And you pointed out that you'll be 93 then.
Something like that. Yeah, something like that. And all right, so
not
we're so. Having
That's
this
not
conversation.
True, by the way, that's not okay. Nearly true. You'd be merely in your 70s.
You know, the line I always use about myself is a line I once heard the great James Garner say to Dan Jenkins. We were out at the Pebble Beach Golf Tournament, and we're walking across the practice screen, and Garner, who is just one of the all-time great actors and great guys and a really good golfer. At that time, Brian, they were casting Dead Solid Perfect as a TV movie. And so Garner is on the putting green getting ready to play in the Pro-Am, and he sees Jenkins walking by, and he says, Danny, remember something. I can play younger. And so, oh,
that's
Brian.
Fantastic.
Is that a great line?
That's
I can play younger.
Yeah. That's,
all right,
well,
so,
from those two guys, picturing the greatest golf writer ever lived, and then one of the great, literally one of the greatest television actors of all time. It's perfect.
And
Mr. Garner.
So we're having this conversation at 1:25 Eastern Time on Thursday, January 24th, which is 15 yes, minutes before your guy, Mr. Koppelman, Tiger Woods, tees off at Torrey Pines. And I want to know what your expectations are from an athlete who turns you as giddy as a high school sophomore just anytime you see him on the television screen.
It is true. It's like when I would see Earl Monroe or Bernard King when I was a kid. I can't. All sort of rational ideas go away. I follow the Tiger Tracker on Twitter if I can't watch. You know, they got this guy, the Tiger Tracker, who goes around following Tiger, and I watch every stroke through the tracker if I don't have time to watch the actual match. But the tournament. Did you hear who he was warming up next to this morning, Tiger?
No.
Right away, it starts with great intrigue. He was warming up next to Patrick Reed. They were next to each other on the driving range.
Oh, great.
Which, following the Ryder Cup, is kind of fascinating to picture. Like, were they talking to each other? Did they play it off? I mean, did Reed say something to him? Neither of those guys is really someone who backs down from the things that they've said, right? Both guys pretty chesty when they need to. And I would have loved to have figured out whoever came second to the range and then saw only that slot open. You know what I mean? It's like when you walk into the lunchroom in high school and there's only just one seat in the whole lunchroom, and it's like at the football player's table, or it's at you got to just like kind of the stoner's table, and you're like, well, I either sit on the floor or I got to walk over to that table. It must have been like that for Patrick Reed, you know, when he settled in there next to Tiger.
All right, so you were, and I say this with great love, just wearing me out the day of the Tiger Mickelson match, which I swear to you, I was not going to buy until your friends, the Lupica boys, my three sons, made me do it. Okay. And then it became fairly absorbing once you realize, Brian, that Mickelson, who sounded like a lung patient, early in the round, you know, it was that he was going to survive the round, and it was all good until they went to extra holes. And I think I mentioned to you either in a text or on Twitter or both that by the end, as darkness was starting to fall on this match, that they had to do everything except putt the ball through the windmill to decide a winner.
So let me go back to, yes, and I was glad that, you know, it was so boring, the match, until the end, that I was glad, actually, we were going back and forth giving each other shit, because,
right.
No, it was necessary to keep the thing somehow. I had my friend John Hamburg, the great screenwriter and director, over, and we were watching it together with my son Sammy, and we just kept trying to make it feel vibrant and exciting and engaging, and you know, by the end, also, yes, the windmill thing, it was like mini golf. But also, you ever see guys give each other six? They're giving each other six footers,
right?
Which was odd to me at the end of this $10 million thing. And look, I'm not going to say that they'd already made a deal ahead of time to share in the winnings, but I do know a little bit about how poker players split up those winnings when they're at a final table sometimes. And it's hard to imagine those guys deciding that they were actually going to do winner take all. I mean, there's almost no way it wasn't. You keep 3.5, I'll keep 3.5. And
yeah, but Brian, it was like those tennis, like Jimmy's challenge matches back in Vegas. It was winner take most.
That's right. Yes, winner take just a little more than the
just
other
just a little
guy.
More, that's yeah.
I think that's what it was. But when you're asking me what I'm expecting from today and from Tiger's season, I'm expecting Tiger to win a major this year, and I am expecting a top 10 finish today, this week, Sunday.
All right, now you know, being the Tiger fanboy that you are, and the only one comparable to you that I have in my range of friends is Michael Greenberg of ESPN, who's as bad as you are, and maybe worse. I know that sounds almost impossible, but it is. Okay, I'm going to give you the list of modern golfers who have won major golf championships after the age of 43. Tiger turned 43 3 weeks ago, same birthday as LeBron James, okay? The oldest is Julius Boros, who was 48 when he won the PGA in 1968. Nicholas, obviously, 46 when he wins the 1986 Masters. I'm not going to count old Tom Morris. Hale Irwin wins the U.S. Open at Medina, age 45. Jerry Barber in 61 wins a PGA at the same
was
age.
Was like 40 when Vijay was 41? Is that right? Vijay was 41 years old.
Trevino wins the PGA. People forget this. Trevino was still winning majors when he was 44 years old. DiVincenzo, okay, here's the age of 43. Now, this can give you some hope and consolation. Guys who have won majors at the age that Tiger is now, okay? Phil Mickelson, British Open, Muirfield, 2013. Ben Crenshaw, Masters, 1995. Raymond Floyd at Shinnecock Hills, 1986, the U.S. Open. Boros, the 63 Open at the Country Club in Brookline. The point I'm making is, and I know that these things kind of get skewed because Tiger now seems to be in such great shape. He made everybody else get in great shape, even after all the surgeries he's had. He's threading a needle here, and it's a long way for me to ask you, if he doesn't win one next year, do you still think he has one in him?
Here's what I think. Everything you said is actually valid, and these kind of comps do mean something. You did speak the caveat, which is his physical conditioning is unlike right. anybody else's who's ever played the game at this level. But also, you and I both know that the mental aspect of winning a major is the thing. He's been close here since he came back, and hasn't won. But I just don't think that anybody else has the wiring that he has, the mental makeup, combined with the physicality, the touch. And watching him last season, I felt like he was so close to getting there. Not that Tiger, you know, Tiger always saying, I'm so close, but it felt to me like he was that close. I think he answered a lot of questions by winning, and I do believe he's going to win another couple of majors before he's done. Because I think if he wins one, I think he rolls. And I think if he wins one, he wins three, four more majors. I do.
But when you look back on last year, and he played some glorious golf, and he played better than I ever thought he would again. And I have followed this sport passionately, as you know, my whole life. Okay, from Nicholas and Palmer and Player and Trevino, all those guys on. Did you not feel though that in some very key moments last year, he showed old man nerves? Both at the British Open and at the PGA. I think I don't know if I ever told you this. I'm watching the last round of the PGA with Zach Lupica, your friend Zach Lupica. And he gets to the 17th tee, and I quietly turned to Zach, and I said, four on the right. And he said, no way. And I said, honey, he's due for one of those. Now, it turned out to be four on the left, okay? And hey, Brian, you know, he's lucky he didn't hit the ball OB, okay? And I just feel that his nerves betrayed him. And the thing I am concerned about, because I know what a good story this is, okay? That those nerves don't get any better for aging golfers as they age.
We all remember, listen, we all remember Watson sculling the ball at the British Open. So we all know.
And the flop shot, and the stupid flop shot when all he's got to do is be happy with a bogey. Because if he makes a bogey on that hole, he can still win the British Open.
Right. So we all remember that. And but, you know, Watson was, 14 years older than Tiger is now or something like that?
He was 59 years old.
So something like that, 16 years older than Tiger is now, and got that close to winning a major, except, yes, you're right, the older person nerves came into play, which is why I say if he wins one, he'll win more, and it's why it's possible that he won't, because of the nerves. But I think also he worked through it last season. I felt like this is a guy who now has felt the pressure again of being there on a Sunday and having a chance and not quite being able to pull it off. Also, Mike, I'm not rational on this subject, right? I got to spend some time with Daryl Morey this week and, you know, the Houston Rockets, and watching the way Morey talks about basketball players, that incredible ability to dispassionately pick them apart by these advanced metrics. I'm not doing any of that when it comes to Tiger. I'm just a flat-out incredible fan. So and I watch incredibly closely. As you know, I went to the Masters for Sports Illustrated last year. I covered the event.
It was great. You were great there. It was such good stuff, too. It was really fun.
Thank you. It was so much fun to do. But, the main reason I said yes to going, I wanted to see Augusta because I'd never seen it, as you and I talked about. But I wanted to see what it was like to see Tiger Woods there at Augusta. So, look, I'm rooting incredibly hard, which makes it more challenging to be dispassionate. That said, I think that the guy has always thrived when the expectations were high and when there were a lot of very public naysayers. And so I think that psychologically he's as ready as he's been in a long time to do this.
We're talking to Brian Koppelman on the Mike Lupica podcast. And so if you're hanging around with Daryl Morey, at least I'm encouraged that you're hanging around with good basketball executives again. Do you understand what I'm saying, Brian? Do you hear what I'm saying to you?
I really do.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying. I happen to like that other guy, but yes, I know what you're saying. Boy, Morey's a smart guy, though, Mike, isn't he?
He is, and I wonder if I wonder what his sense. Anxiety is probably not the right word, Brian, but what his sense is that the door is closing, even with James Harden on his side. On a, you talk about a now team. They've been a now team for 2 or 3 years now, and they just may be. I'll give you a tennis analogy that you will appreciate because I know you love tennis the way I love tennis, okay? They just may be Andy Roddick. They just may have been born at the wrong time, meaning the time of the Golden State Warriors.
No, of course. I'm thinking about it, and yes, there are a few other of those also. Like there's Vitas is another good example of that because he only had he won the one major, but the other guys were just so much better. I thought last year that the Rockets would go deeper. I was surprised that they're.
And then Paul got hurt. Paul got hurt.
But then they shot so poorly. But on the other hand, how much fun is it watching this team? Like watching that game last night against my guys, right? Against the Knicks. I hate Dolan, but I'm sitting there. And watching that first half performance, I texted Morey and I said, hey, don't let them pull Harden out of this game. Let's see him get 80. Because, I want him to break Melo's record.
Right.
And I want him to get it, 82 or 84. Think about the fact that the guy scores 61 the season he's having. He scores 61. We all talk about it a little bit. But in any other season, a guy going for 61, Mike, it would be the leading story on all the sports shows.
Right.
I bet you that on the ESPN run today of, high noon, highly questionable, PTI, I bet you Harden's third or fourth. Like, we're taking for granted the 61 because of what this guy's doing night in and night out. Have you seen anything like this with a small a guy having a season like this in your life?
No, and Brian, you'll appreciate this too. What he's doing is he's having a season the way Bernard King had a month one time.
Yes, exactly. When Bernard had the back-to-back 50-point games and then got to the beat Isaiah in the playoffs. You've rarely seen this. I mean, yes, like Lloyd B. Free had a few weeks where he was, or Maravich. Maravich put 62 on the Pearl once. But this is a totally different, this is an entirely different situation. I've never seen the way he's doing it either, man.
Now, I got to ask you about him. Brian, I got to ask you about it. You were there last night. And Brian and I first met at the Garden.
I wasn't there. I didn't go last night. I watched it on TV.
Okay, so you watched the game. But we first met because of his Knickness, okay? And he loves the Knicks the way, but he did not as long as our dear late friend Bill Goldman did. But I met Brian kind of through Bill and met Sammy, his son, when he was, what was Sammy, like 10 years old when I first met him, Brian?
Younger, much younger. Because you came to the Rounders thing, Sam was 2 or 3.
Okay, so now I broke in New York covering the Knicks, and I got to see Earl Monroe in games that only I cared about writing about at that time. Okay. And it was clear that Clyde couldn't do it anymore. And Earl Monroe for like a 500 season was one of the greatest shows I've ever seen in sports. And sometimes I felt literally as if I was the only one who cared. So I love basketball. Why don't I love watching James Harden play basketball? You explain this to me. Why don't I love the guy?
I've been thinking about this a lot because I do love the guy. I love watching him play. First of all, I love watching him play because, and maybe this will help you, because he was cast out. Westbrook and Durant were the chosen two, and they cast Harden out. And so that puts a chip on a guy's shoulder who knows he's actually better than one of those guys, right? Durant's one of the greatest players of all time, but Harden knows, wait a second, I believe I can win. I believe that I'm every bit the scorer that Russell Westbrook is, and I'm a better guy. And so I can't believe... I'm also always loved outside shooters, right? When we were young, when I was young and you were first covering basketball, downtown Freddie Brown was like an amazement to all of us that a guy could shoot from where Freddie Brown shot from, right? When Chris Ford started making those threes, we couldn't believe it. Think about what James Harden's doing. I've never seen anybody. The step back, and I don't buy the argument that it's a travel, and I'll tell you why, because they all travel. Everybody travels. Once everyone said the Euro step was okay, the traveling rules don't apply. Superstars always get that call. So maybe you don't like it because it seems like it's an isolation. It's kind of an old-fashioned return to, hey, we're going to all load up one side. We're going to give it to him on the other side. We're going to let him work. Maybe it feels selfish to you. But to me, I just see a guy having a season that your kids are going to tell their kids about. Like, I remember seeing James Harden score 40 points 18 games in a row and winning. You know, it's not like they're losing. Like, they win. And Chris Paul's still not around. So I think you should look at it differently. I think you should look at it as a guy who is willing. He has to know that there's a cost to this, and he's just willing to do it to try to win and get them into the playoffs. And because the numbers are so gaudy, maybe it seems selfish, but you watched the game last night. I mean, don't you think he had to? Every one of those 61 points mattered.
Oh, no, I wanted him to score. I was with you. I wanted him to score 80 points. You know what I was saying as you said this? My dear friend, the great Bob Ryan, says that whenever anybody kind of looks like a celebrity, Ryan says there's two kinds of peoples. There reminds you ofs and there's looks likes, okay? Harden is a reminds you of Oscar Robertson. And I know that you're talking about a guy who's if he's not on Mount Rushmore, he's on the side of the hill. OK, and remember him, you know, he's a little before your time, but he was a backup pound the ball guy who still, you know, averaged a triple double for a season one time.
Right.
But Harden's like Oscar 2.0, Brian.
Yeah, it's when you see the fact that guy, everyone knows what he's going to do, and they can't do anything about it. That's what always amazes me. Like, he posted up last night, he had his back to the basket for a second. He was on the right side of the floor, just outside of the lane. Everyone knows they're trying to get the ball into him, and I was really focusing on how he positioned himself to get the ball. There are these little things, right? If you're a guy who's going to have the ball that much of the time, and I was trying to figure out, how does he get the ball? Like, everyone in the arena is trying to stop this guy from getting the ball, and somehow he's able to put himself in a position, block the other dude out, put his left hand down, and get the point guard to get the ball into him. And so for me, watching these little things, it's kind of amazing to think about it. I mean, imagine if you were on the court, when everyone's trying to stop you from getting the ball, it's really freaking hard to get the ball. And he not only gets the ball, then everyone knows he's going to shoot. He steps back, he shoots over four guys, and he gets a four-point play. So I'm digging it for some reason. I'm trying to watch all the Rockets games all season long. I've been watching them because it's just such a remarkable thing.
Talking to my friend Brian Koppelman on the Mike Lubega podcast, and only because of Brian's range of interests have we talked about, had a conversation this long, and I promise you we will get to billions. Brian, I sometimes think I'm the only one who really cares about this, but as a New Yorker, you have to appreciate what Kenny Atkinson is doing with the Brooklyn Nets, who were as more of a lost boy franchise than the New York Knicks were because of the things that were done and the horrible trades and all the draft choices that they gave away. And here they are over 500, right behind the Celtics in the Eastern Conference. How come if they can do it, the Knicks can't?
Well, you're talking about the difference between James Dolan and now Joe Tsai and Abramovich or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole organization is geared. The Nets now are geared toward winning. They're trying to win. The last time the Nets were caught my attention before now was like Bubbles Hawkins was playing on the team. And so that's pretty good, right? I didn't even know you were going to bring up the Nets, and I have Bubbles Hawkins right in my pocket. But I have to say, yeah, it's really impressive what they're doing, and I think the new ownership is really strong. The answer has nothing to do, though, with the Nets. The answer has to do with the Knicks and the fact that James Dolan just it's like he's – I think I've said it before, I've compared him to Fredo Corleone. What he's really like is the king in the Lord of the Rings franchise who's been given that under that spell and so can't think, can't talk, is just walking around in a somnolent haze.
Did you read the piece that Ian O'Connor did for ESPN.com, his long sit-down with Dolan?
No, it got sent to me by 25 different people, but I couldn't possibly. I couldn't possibly read it. I don't want to say I'll read his obituary because that's mean-spirited, so I won't say it. But, you know, that's the next time I want to read about James Dolan. That should get me invited to the Garden. That should get me invited to the Garden soon.
I'm talking to Brian Koppelman on the Mike Lupica podcast. Do you have any belief in any of these young guys the Knicks have?
I want to say one thing, though, which is when I talk about James Dolan, I'm really talking about James Dolan, the owner of the Knicks. Like, the truth is that his family's done an incredible amount of good for pancreatic cancer. So on that side of it, as a human away from the Knicks, I actually don't have any animus toward James Dolan. I just hate him as a guy who owns the Knicks. I do want to say that my mom died of pancreatic cancer, and I've seen the work that they do, and it's incredible, the Les Garden Foundation, and I support that completely. I just wish he would devote all his time to that and none of his time to the Knicks.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this 1,000 times. It's you can't process what has happened to the New York Knicks over the last 2 decades. Since the year,
that's right.
Since
that's
the right. Season that ended in 2000, when a wounded team still nearly made it back to the NBA Finals, coached by Jeff Van Gundy. Remember, they played that really compelling 6-game series against the Pacers. And
I was there for all those games that went.
Yeah, me too. And they almost had enough left, that aging wounded team, to make it back to the finals. Since that series, they have won one playoff series. And you say it, and people say, "Oh no, the Knicks are bad." No, they're worse than you think. They're worse than you think. They've won one playoff series in 19 years. One. And this isn't the T-Wolves, the other team that they're at the bottom of the standings. They and the T-Wolves have lost more games than anybody else in the sport over this time, okay? This is the Knicks, okay? This is Clyde and Bill and Dave and your guy, Phil the Thrill Jackson, okay? And Captain Willis. One playoff series in 19 years. Nothing like this has ever happened in New York sports to anybody.
I mean, you're just trying to kill me dead, dude.
Do you like Knox? Do you think there's a future play?
Oh, I do. I think that the fact that he had such a great game at such a young age, you know, when he scored the 36 points, and he's 19 years old, it showed me that his potential is what we thought it was, and that, yeah, I do really like him. The fear is that the Knicks don't seem to do very well with maximizing these guys, right? And so, yeah, if you were playing in the right – I like Fizdale, by the way. While we're here, I think Fizdale's a good coach, and I think he wants to win, and I think he's going to try his darndest to win. So maybe he can make the most of the kid. I really hope so.
All right,
but it's funny, right? You know, I'm like the most optimistic, hopeful person in the world about every subject except the New York Knicks. Like, if someone follows my Twitter feed, all they'll see is me being super enthusiastic and optimistic and helpful and hopeful, unless the Knicks come up. And then I seem like I make Sylvia Plath seem like Richard Simmons.
We thought there was a sign from heaven the day of Bill Goldman's memorial service when you and Simmons – went to the game against the Bucks, and they won in overtime. And when Susan Burden, the love of Bill's life, came into the after party after the memorial service and told me the result, and all I could think was, oh, sure, now they're going to win a game like that.
Well, yes, but it was perfect that we left it. When we left the memorial service, Bill Simmons and I both went. We shared a cab up to the game, and it was amazing that they were able to win that game. But I can't tell you, it gave me a sense that it was
divine intervention.
No. Yes, I like to believe that. I like to believe that it was Bill. I do. Let's believe that it was Bill. But then, why can't he keep it going for us?
Well, he's got other interests now.
Fair enough.
And for anybody who didn't hear it, our friend Bill Simmons did a 2.5. It was the first podcast, Brian, that required an intermission. Okay, after Bill Goldman died, and it was Brian was on it, and I was on it, and it was just one of the most. In a sad time, it was an incredibly happy-making experience because you knew just listening to Bill, and then I listened to you, and that you know, 100 years from now, they'll still be talking about the works of William Goldman.
Well, it's true. You watch that. Let's just for 1 second say it. I mean, you watch that 20-minute film that Tony Gilroy and Scott Frank put together, and I mean, that doesn't even scratch the surface of it. And it's every line you can ever imagine, every moment. Your friend William Goldman, who I got to know as well, and who was incredibly kind to me, was simply as great at his chosen field, which is my chosen field, as a human being could be, and an equally great person. And so we all miss him every day. And it was wonderful to watch that film that those dudes made because it brought him right back to life for me.
Brian, we're talking Brian Koppelman on the Mike Lubica podcast. We're talking about the great William Goldman. Were you still there when Scott spoke and asked any writer in the room who Bill had influenced?
Oh, yeah, like 50 people stood up.
Oh, my God. Scott said to me afterwards, he said, I don't. And by the way, Scott Frank is a brilliant screenwriter himself and director. And he said, you don't know how that's going to play. And when I turned my head and saw that many people standing in the room, it actually took my breath away.
Listen, there's no... His work would have been that influential whether he was a great man or not. The fact that he was a great man, an unselfish man, a giving man, makes it all that much better because often people who produce that kind of work let the work sort of stand for itself and they're not that interested. They're so in their own head, in their own imagination, in their own work, that they just don't have time. But Bill Goldman focused on, if you were a writer, you were a brother to him, or you were a son to him, or you were somebody that he wanted to help and guide. And we all felt it, and it was an incredible and amazing thing. And it was an honor to know the guy.
All right. Before we get to Billions, I feel like I've teased this the whole time, but believe me, we will talk about Billions.
Also, for getting nothing. I mean, also, when you get there, you're getting nothing out of me. So,
yeah, but I can try. No.
It's going to be like Al Capone's vault, Lupica. We're going to open it up, and there's nothing's going to be there.
No, I have some big, as I told you in a text last night, I'm a big picture guy, okay? So I'm going to try to, as always, lead you into a trap. I know you won't fall into it, but it's okay. Very quickly, observations, things that pissed you off about the Oscar nominations, things you like. I know you didn't like the movie Green. You did not like Green Book. I actually kind of liked it just because I thought Viggo Mortensen was so good.
No, I haven't said that I didn't like Green Book. I would say I'm not that fun to have this conversation with, and I'll tell you why. Because I know how hard it is to make a movie. I really don't want to bag on movies. I will say that I thought First Reformed should have gotten a Best Picture nomination. It got Best Screenplay, but for my money, that was just an exceptionally great film. I thought Mission Impossible was an incredible film that Chris McQuarrie made as good a popcorn movie as you can possibly make. But I'm not a big Oscar prognosticator as our friend Mr. Goldman was. I also think, like, it is just, in this environment, if you can get people to go to the movies, so for instance, I did not love Bohemian Rhapsody, but I was with three smart people when I saw the movie, and every one of the three, now they were not in the business, right? But the three people I was with loved it. They got everything they wanted out of it. And for me,
I didn't love the film. Like, the performance is great, but the film didn't move me. But I get it. Like, I looked at the whole theater. It wasn't just the three people I was with. You walked out of the theater, and everybody in the room was smiling widely, except a lot of people in our business, in my business, who were all film snobs in some way, and sort of a lot of us didn't dig it that much. But I can't begrudge it the nomination, you know, because it really brought joy to people.
And as did A Star Is Born. And Star Is Born is almost like a separate category, because I just think people loved Lady Gaga, and they loved that Bradley Cooper, who's a very popular guy, took this kind of swing.
Yeah.
And it I mean, Brian, here's a funny story. We Taylor Lupica and I took our 20-year-old daughter to see it, okay? And we're walking out of the theater afterwards, and she looks at her mother and she said, "You could have told me." And Taylor said, "Well, honey, did you think they were going to live happily ever after?" And she said,
"No, I mean, also, we had the benefit of having seen the other versions of it."
Well, that's what I told her, Brian. I said, "Honey, this movie's been remade like 5 times. You know that, right?"
I'm happy about that movie. I wish that Cooper would have gotten the Best Director. The thing I'm the happiest about the Oscars, actually, is that Spike Lee got Best Picture and Best Director. He's been ripped off for years not getting those nominations. He may do the right thing, didn't get Best Director, didn't get Best Picture nominations, and that's crazy to me. That movie has stood the test of time in every way, and so for Spike to get a nomination makes me really, really happy. And not because of the brotherhood of the Knicks. I just feel like he's one of the great filmmakers of our time, and he really, by the Academy, has not gotten recognized properly.
I haven't seen it. Everybody in my family except me, I think, saw Vice. Okay, so I didn't see Vice. But everybody who has seen it says that it's not just makeup and weight gain, that it's an amazing performance by Christian Bale.
Christian Bale is an astonishing actor, right? I mean, truly astonishing, brilliant, genius of an actor. So, yeah, it's way beyond just the makeup. All right, I got to go back to set. So if we're going to get to Billions, let's do it.
Okay. We're talking about Billions, and Brian will tell you a lot of stuff that's going to happen in season 4. Which comes out when? Which drops when?
March 17th. All right, you got it. March 17th, 2019. There's a trailer online. You can follow me on Twitter at Brian Koppelman. I'll be tweeting about it all the time and trying to help people find it.
Go ahead. A few more minutes. All right. Now, here's the thing. And you, I saw you quoted as saying that the way last season ended, and I mean, do we still have to say spoiler alert about the way last season ended?
If you haven't watched last season, guys, you can stop now and go watch and then come back.
Okay.
We're going to talk about the show.
But you say, for you and David, that was always in the plans. And I'm not going to ask you if that's true, but was it in the plans from the jump, or at some point in the first 3 seasons did you decide that if you guys are going to go forward that these two lanes had to intersect?
Yeah, what we knew in the sort of macro sense was we knew that Axe was going to win the first season and that Chuck was going to kind of win the second season.
Right.
And that the third season needed to do this different thing. That the third season needed to find a way for these forces to join. If we could do it. Now, when I say we knew, we let ourselves find the story each season, but you want to have some stuff in your back pocket. And I would say we had that notion in our back pocket. We always knew Axe was getting arrested at the end of season 2. And then we knew, well, but the show's not going to be, then he goes to jail. So we had to, you know, the third season wasn't just going to be Axe over and out of the show. So we knew we had to do something else with it. And we left the breadcrumbs in the season before to pick up on the thing Wendy did. We left enough stuff so that we could march into that place. And we were just so thrilled with the way people responded to it, you know?
And would you, if I had told you when Billions was starting, and again, I don't even think this is a spoiler alert, that as we entered season 4, okay, as we entered season 4, that the great enemies, you'd have two steel cage matches, that's for you, okay, Taylor yes, versus Axe and Connerty versus Chuck. Would you have seen that that was a possibility?
So, well, we wouldn't. Yeah, well, here's what we would have known back then, and I'm not even going to tell you that that's what happens during this season. But I'll say what we knew then was that Connerty and Chuck had to be pointed against. We knew that what Connerty believed in and what Chuck cared about were may have seemed similar on the surface, but from the very beginning, when we cast the role of Connerty, we knew that it had to be somebody who you believe would stand up to Chuck at a certain point.
Okay, a couple more questions. I'm going to let you go. And oh my God, be still your heart. Tiger parred the first hole. Okay, so.
Okay.
Did you see Taylor coming? Or is this the obviously it always starts with writing. So this didn't happen in a vacuum, but the performance has been so tremendous. Did Taylor just become a force that you got, that you felt you had to get out of the way of?
I'll flip it for you. So Asia Kate Dillon is as great an actor as you could ever hope to work with. And no part of Asia's success or the way Taylor's resonating surprised us from the moment Asia walked on set and began to play the character. But here's how this stuff works. Yes, we mapped out in season two that Taylor was going to have this huge role before casting Asia, right? We mapped out the way we wanted it to go, meaning we knew Taylor would, when Axe was going to get arrested at the end of season two, we needed somebody who at season three could take the lead at Axe Capital. And we certainly hoped that it would be that character. But let's say the person we cast wasn't Asia, and somehow the magic wasn't there. Then in the writer's room, you zig and zag, right? You then have the ability to sort of go, well, that plan isn't working. Let's do something else. But what happened here was as soon as Asia started playing the character, I'd say the third episode Asia was in, way before it aired, you know what I mean? A year before it aired, Dave and I called Showtime, and we said, we're sending you guys this footage. You're going to watch it, and then you got to make this character, this person, a regular on the show. We have to now put Asia Kate Dillon in the show for the run of the show. And we said that after 2-3 episodes because it was so clear that our plan could not only happen, but we could go even further with it because of how great they are.
Okay, I got two more questions about Billions, and I promise I'm going to let you go. One is, it's just an open-ended question. How much are we going to see Malkovich this year?
What's the next question?
Damn it. See, I thought that was just sort of a, if I asked it quickly. No, come on. Yeah. Come on.
What's the next question? What do we got?
Bobby Valentine once told me that Mike Piazza's value to the Mets in those days, okay, wasn't just his talent as a hitter. And he said to me, when your best player is also a good guy, it filters down through the other 24. Is that what we see with the dynamic of Billions, starting with Paul and Damian?
This is a fun one. Yeah, this is, I would say, you know, a lot of this stuff is luck. But one thing, because Dave and I, when we got the show, let's say I'm 52 now. I guess we were 40 this season four. I guess it was 48, 49. We had been at this long enough that we spent a lot of time with everybody in the cast before we cast them in the show. And the same thing with the crew, because we knew in success we'd have to do this for a long time. And we just wanted to hire good people. Like, they had to be the actors that we wanted. But they equally important to us was they were people we wanted to spend our days with. And every person who comes through this show, whether on crew or on cast, makes it a point to tell people that they've never had an environment that's as caring and familial and warm as this one. And that comes right from those two guys and from Maggie Sipp and from Asia. These are people who care about other, you know, often artists, as I said earlier about Goldman, don't, these people all care about everybody else's day. They don't just ask you how you are. They actually give a shit. They're prepared every day when they come to work. It's that part of this is a total delight. You know, we're working long hours, man. We work 18-hour days. Dave and I are working all weekend long. And I don't think I could do it if these people weren't the level of quality that they are. These are super quality people. And so, yes, it does feel like that. I think that's a great quote from Bobby V. And I didn't know that about Piazza. That's good to know.
And the big cameo this year was the guy that you were No, I can't even do it. It's not even. I can't do it.
Here's the thing, right? What's going to happen is there are some fun. I will say this. I'm happy to say there are a couple of fun appearances by some fascinating people. And I really do think, Mike, I will say when I get texts from you when the show airs and you'll tell me that you guys dug it or something, it's really fun. And I do love interacting with people during the season. And the whole reason that we don't want to spoil stuff is we want it to be super fun for you watching it. You know, I remember with Mad Men, I was so glad that Matt never spoiled the show so that every Sunday night something happened that I couldn't have anticipated. And I think it's one of the pleasures of still having a show that runs once a week and you can't binge it till the end of the season is that we can leave you wondering and then you have to wait a week to pick it up again. And I think there's something thrilling about it.
Brian Koppelman is one of the most talented people I know. Not enough good things can possibly happen to him. He's going to go back to rehearsal now. You have my number.
We're shooting by now. If we were still rehearsing, it'd be a problem. But
okay,
I got to go back down the set.
If anything happens and you need any input from me, I'm here for you. Okay.
I'm going to go tell Mr. Giamatti right now that you've walked. I'm going to put it out so that you've walked.
Thanks, pal.
Right,
be well.
I'm not Paul. Mike, talk to you soon. Bye.
The great Brian Koppelman on the Mike Lupica podcast. It's reached the point. We do this every year. We do this in the run up to Billions every year, and I try to get stuff out of him. And I just finally gave up today. If you know how addictive the show is, and you know what a hot show it is, you know the buzz about it has just built and built. March 17th, season 4 starts. Again, these are the kind of conversations we have every single week. Soon it will be 2 a week. Continue to download, continue to subscribe. We wouldn't be going to 2 a week if you didn't like this podcast as much as Tyler Brewer, my producer, and I like doing it. And I will talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.